Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. There aren't many things in life that matter quite as much as food. I mean, it's as essential as water, as air, to our very survival. And of course, beyond that, food also gives us a great deal of pleasure. And in some respects, food is also a means to identity, to connecting with our past, to experience the world in all of its richness and wonderful variety. And unfortunately, food can also be an arena of deceit. And that is the story of a really intriguing book called Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. And I hasten to add that this book by Larry Olmsted is not just a book that sort of goes on in relentless fashion about one wrongdoing after another. One of the things I appreciate about this book is that it is also a celebration of the world's greatest food, the most wonderful food, and the food which is, in a sense, the most real. And it also helps explain, then, why there are, in a sense, counterfeiters who are trying to pass off poor substitutes or imitators of the real thing. But anyway, the book really examines both. And Larry Olmsted, the author, knows what he's talking about. I'm sure many of you have read his Great American Bites column for USA Today. And he is the food and travel columnist for Forbes.com. His work appears in all kinds of different places. And by the way, he teaches writing at Dartmouth College. This book, again, is called Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. Larry Olmsted, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thank you also for recognizing the real food side of the book. You know, I did call it Real Food, Fake Food rather than Fake Food, Real Food on purpose because the real food's important, but a lot of people have just seized on sort of the negative aspects of it.
Right. I appreciate that both elements are there. And by the way, just now I am realizing that you and I have spoken once before, although it was a few years ago, but I recorded an interview with you about your book, Getting Into Guinness, One Man's Longest, Fastest, Highest Journey Inside the World's Most Famous Record Book.
It's been a few years.
Right. So I'm glad now that we can be reconnecting. Ahead of us talking about your book, could I just ask you about your sort of general background? At what point in your life did food become such an important sort of point of focus for you, both professionally and, I assume, personally as well?
Well, I mean, I've always loved food. I grew up in New York City, you know, which had, you know, even back then, a lot of diversity of cuisine. And, you know, my father had served in Japan and after World War II, so, and had worked as an engineer in South America. So he came back with a lot of sort of interesting tastes that weren't popular at the time, and he would drag us around to different ethnic enclaves in New York to find these foods. There was no sushi on every block back then. So, you know, I always had a deep appreciation of food, but I've been primarily a travel writer and journalist for the last 20-plus years, and people travel for a lot of reasons. Some people go to museums. Some people just want to lay on the beach. Some people, you know, want to ski or golf or climb mountains, but no matter what you travel for, you eat every day, usually two or three or four times. So that's sort of been the commonality as I've gone around the world. I've focused a lot on the eating experience.
Hmm. At what point did it become apparent to you that there was a really serious problem, primarily here in the United States, with what you call fake food?
Well, you know, the sort of genesis for me personally was on one of my trips to Japan about, I don't know, a dozen years ago. I had Kobe beef, which is, you know, like sort of the Rolls Royce of red meat. It's one of these things. It's almost mythical. It's pricey. It's rare. Most people never try it, but it's famous and it's well known as this high end beef. And then I returned to this country, not knowing much more about Kobe beef, except that, you know, I'd had it, and it's very distinctive looking and tasting, much different from the meat we're used to. And then in this country, I would see it occasionally as I traveled on kind of high-end restaurant menus, and once or twice or three times I ordered it, and it never reminded me at all of what I had tasted in Japan, which was, you know, very unique. And I started to wonder why, and I just did a little research, and I found out that at the time, the importation of Japanese beef was completely banned by the USDA. There was no Kobe beef at all on these shores, yet hundreds of restaurants coast to coast had it on the menu, often for very high prices. And I did a story for Forbes about, you know, how this Kobe beef scam, as I called it, and it really resonated with readers. I was surprised by the response and how upset people felt, especially because it's a fairly minor niche food. So I just did more and more research, and, you know, I kind of came to the conclusion, whenever somebody goes to Italy, they come back and they always say, all the food there is so much better, even just pasta with red sauce. Why is that? And I started to think, well, why is that, right? Because you can buy tomatoes and basil and pasta and garlic here. And the reality is, when I looked into a lot of these, you know, delicious foods from around the world, they're faked over here.
Hmm. Well, and beyond that, you know, as I said, your book is not just about the fakery, and that's a fascinating thing to explore, but your book is also about the real thing, and it explores some of the reasons why, for instance, Parmigiano cheese is so delicious when it's from Parma, Italy, and certain wines and certain seafood and so on, that there is a reason why these particular foods are at their best, at a sense their most authentic, in the places from which they originate. It's not an accident.
No, it's not. I mean, it's usually, you know, what they call terroir, which is why, you know, Vidalia onions grow better in Vidalia, Georgia than they would elsewhere in the country. And, you know, places are famous for Georgia's famous for peaches, and Jersey's famous for sweet corn. And, you know, things grow differently all around the country and around the world. And, you know, there's natural reasons for that. But, you know, the good news is that you can get real Parmesan Reggiano here in the United States, and you can get great olive oil, and you could, in fact, replicate that great meal you had in Italy. You just have to know how to buy every single ingredient.
We're speaking with Larry Olmsted, and we're talking about his book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. Ahead of us exploring a couple of the sort of specifics that you talk about in such interesting detail in your book, I think it would be good to first of all talk about a couple of the different ways in which food fakery occurs, because I think this is important in our understanding sort of just how complicated a question this is. I think you spell out several different ways in which this fakery can occur. What are the most significant ones for us to understand?
Well, really, there's legal and then illegal fakery. So legal would be something like Kobe beef or champagne or Parmesan cheese that is not from the place we think it is, or what I would call the real thing. But the United States, as a rule, does not honor geographically based trademarks when it comes to food. So the people who make Kobe beef and the people who make Parmesan cheese, and most famously champagne, have been unable to get legal protections in this country. And if you ask almost anyone, you know, what is champagne, people say, oh, it's a sparkling wine, has to come from France. And there's this, it's almost a victim of its own success. There's this huge perception that champagne, that you cannot label wine champagne in this country, but you can, in fact, and a lot of it is, and wine labeled champagne is made in upstate New York and California and Texas and lots of places, and that's legal, but it's to me misleading because people think they're getting a higher quality product than they are. Then there's the illegal food fraud, which is usually adulteration or substitution. Adulteration would be you buy a jar of honey, and honey is a single ingredient food. It says just honey, but maybe it's cut with high fructose corn syrup or beet sugar or something that is cheaper than honey, so they increase their profit margin and you can't really tell as a consumer. And then the ultimate would be pure substitution, which happens a lot with seafood, where you order, say, red snapper, and instead you get a completely different species of fish that is lower in quality, lower in price, and potentially dangerous.
There's also this matter then of the difference between counterfeits and imposters. And I found this really, really interesting. And particularly when you're talking about what you call utter imposters, that this is something that is often systemic in nature. Talk
right.
about that.
Well, you know, there have been numerous cases of food fraud where it's similar to, say, art fraud. So you take a bottle of wine and you put a label on it that says it's a rare vintage of Burgundy from the 80s, the kind of thing you might buy at a wine auction if you were a collector. And that's like a forgery. It would be just like sort of forging a painting where, you know, it's just an utter fallacy. But the problem is you also can't necessarily, you know, do much about that. If it's a good fake, you can't tell. So, you know, that fortunately for the average consumer is more of a rarity. They don't they don't suffer from that. What they would suffer more from is the case of you buying, say, lobster ravioli frozen in the store and it containing no lobster.
Right.
That's the kind of, you know, utter fake that does affect the consumer. Or as they had in Europe, the horse meat scandal, where you buy frozen beef lasagna and it's not beef at all.
Right. You say in the introduction to the book that, you know, you knew something about fake food, and then the longer you investigated it, you know, the angrier you got. And in particular, you were not prepared for the scale of it. I mean, that this is something that occurs so much more often than most of us would ever dream. Just give us a sense of what those disturbing numbers are. I mean, just how common and widespread a problem is this?
Well, the sort of primary academic research in the United States is done at the Michigan State University, which has a food fraud initiative. And the Michigan State Food Fraud Initiative estimated about $50 billion a year industry in fake food. And just to show that that's not really off the mark, in the UK, where they do a lot of research of this kind, the Royal Society of Chemists did a similar study, and they estimated $49 billion. So it's pretty close. And then the Grocery Manufacturers Association of America estimates that 10% of the commercially available food in this country is adulterated in one way or another. And that's, you know, 10%. It's better than 90%, but it's a lot. It means, you know, 1 out of 10 items in your supermarket cart. And that's kind of what I guess I expected, was some number like 1 in 10. But then in what really shocked me was in things like seafood, where for a particular fish, again, like red snapper, it could be more like 19 times out of 20 you're getting a fake. I mean, some of these are really high levels of substitution. Hmm.
You also say in the introduction that almost equal to your anger over the fakery being done is what you call our government's participation and complicity in fake food. We could probably have a full-length interview just about that, because I suspect that that's where some of this gets especially complicated when it comes to the letter of the law and the way in which law is either poorly crafted or poorly enforced or ignored altogether. What is that complicity that angers you so much about our government's role in this?
Well, a lot of that has to do with these what I call the geographic indications, which are, you know, foods associated with a place, again, like the champagne or the Kobe beef. And this is something that is not – it's not an accident that we do not respect the laws of our closest and oldest allies. This is something we've intentionally chosen to do. And particularly in the example of champagne, there are only 6 countries – in the entire world that will not recognize the French ownership of the word champagne. And the U.S. is not in great company. It's the other 5 are Russia, Argentina, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Belarus. So, you know, we are outliers in this topic. And So that is something that we have, I mean, the European Union and France and our allies have been trying to negotiate this with us for 200 years, and we've sort of steadfastly refused to accept it. And you can read the government regulations specifying how, you know, it's fine to make champagne and Burgundy and Chianti and port and sherry and all of these geographically unique products in this country. So that's what I mean by complicity. And then a lot of it is just a failure to do a decent job, where it's more indifference.
Hmm. Your book explores several different facets of the food industry where this is a rampant problem. You begin, for some reason, in Parma, Italy, and want to tell us about Parmigiano cheese, or Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, I guess, is the more proper name. I'm just curious. I mean, it's a fascinating place to begin. So in some ways, I don't even need to ask you this. But for the sake of our listeners, why did you think this was a great place to begin this exploration of food fakery?
Well, because if you ask most Americans, you know, where would you like to go eat, or what's your favorite kind of food, or where have you been that you love the food, you hear Italy, Italy, Italy all over. People love Italian food. Food in Italy is great. But what a lot of people don't realize, because it's a little bit off the tourist radar, is that Parma is really Italy's gourmet food epicenter for production. So not a lot of Americans go there. They go to Florence and Tuscany and Rome and Milan and Sicily, you know, as tourists. But in Parma, they're making not only the Parmigiano Reggiano, the king of cheeses, but prosciutto di Parma, which is probably the world's most famous ham. They make fantastic balsamic vinegars around there. Barilla, the world's largest pasta company, is based there. Parmalat, which is Italy's largest agriculture food producer of any kind, is based there. That's why it's called Parmalat. And, you know, in addition, the area around it is just full of great restaurants. But more than that, it's that, you know, people nowadays have a lot of different issues when it comes to food. Some people care about the carbon footprint, how much it cost and resources to produce, or how far it travels, the environmental impact, the social impact, the economic impact. There's a lot of different sort of politics of food, and I look at Parma as a very virtuous system where not only are the products produced naturally, the cows that, you know, they use the milk from the to make the cheese have to eat only natural grass and wildflowers that can't be fertilized, can't have pesticides, they can't use drugs in the cows, it's ultra fresh. But the process goes on and on, and the leftover whey from the milk process is then fed to the pigs that make the prosciutto di Parma, and that's one of the reasons why that prosciutto tastes so good. And the bankers, the dairies, the inspectors, they're all highly interconnected. And as I say, you know, the story of Parmesan cheese does not really begin with the milk. It begins with the spring and the grass and the flowers growing, and it's this sort of closed circle where, you know, that shows that you don't have to generate a lot of waste and have a lot of inefficiency to produce an entire culture of great food.
Mm. And this is probably as good an example as any in your book of this French term terroir, T-E-R-R-O-I-R, which is, in a sense, that idea of food having a particular place, a sense of place, and that it has even more to it has more to it has to do with more than just the soil in which something is growing, but it also has to do with the people and the culture and all of the ways in which this all interlocks in an extraordinary way. I mean, and in a way that's pretty foreign to us here in America.
Right. Well, a lot of these geographically indicated famous foods really predate the existence of our country. I mean, they've been making this cheese the same way in Parma for somewhere between 800 and 1,000 years. And the cheesemakers tend to be a job that's passed down from father to son, or very rarely from father to daughter. But, you know, no one in Parma is looking for a cheaper, shortcut way to make the cheese. As you know, as far as they're concerned, they make an awesome cheese, and there's only one way to make that. And I think that that's great, because it keeps the tradition alive. And it's not, you know, it's not just the cheese. There's a lot of great products. And it's not just, you know, Europe when it comes to terroir. I mean, we have that here in the United States. It's why wines from the Napa Valley command a price premium over all other wines produced in the New World, because the conditions are better for growing grapes there.
When it comes to this Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, you tell us, you know, that it's an incredibly intricate process. You write, from the first time a calf grazes in Parma, every single step of cheese production, from temperatures to length of aging to the size of wheels to the types of round molds used, is not only set in stone, but is also strictly enforced by a mini army of inspectors. Their full-time job is to do nothing but verify and later grade the quality of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese with a devotion that seeks nothing less than perfection. Can you just say a quick word about this inspection process? It's really fascinating in and of itself.
Right. Well, there are very few foods in the world where that are 100% physically inspected. You know, when if you're a farmer and you grow tomatoes, you don't have to have anybody from the government come and look at every one of your tomatoes and tell you it's good to go to the store. But if you're making Parmigiano Reggiano, you have to do exactly that. And a government inspector comes and examines every single wheel. And they have a little rubber percussion hammer. They tap the wheel all over. I've seen this done. They put their ear to it, and they listen for hollow sounds, which suggest that the cheese hasn't properly crystallized. And then if there's a question about the structure, they hit it with their hammer, and maybe it doesn't sound right. They put a little auger in it and take a core sample. And if need be, they actually will taste the cheese. So every wheel is hand-inspected by people who's trained, and their sole job is to inspect cheese. And about 8% of the wheels are rejected for not meeting the quality standard. And I think of it like if somebody thoroughly tested every smartphone or TV or computer that we bought before they left the factory and 8% of them were rejected, we'd have very few returns to Best Buy, you know? So it's a great quality system. But on top of that, there's not many foods that you can say, if you buy it, it's always going to be good. Sometimes you get a good tomato. Sometimes you get a great tomato. Sometimes you get a boring tomato. But, you know, Parmigiano Reggiano, Champagne, these products, there is no bad version. The quality control is so strict that just to earn the label, it has to be an exemplary product.
So tell our listeners about the experience of a friend of yours named Alice Fix. First of all, explain what she does for a living, and then explain what happened one night when friends of hers took her out for dinner at one of the most famous restaurants in New York City.
Alice Fix is, she's sort of retired now, but for a long time she's been a publicist for a variety of companies, a lot of European companies, and for a long time one of the people she one of the groups she represented was the Parmigiano Reggiano Consortio, which is the basically association of cheese producers in Parma. And Alice is from New York, but she lives in Italy about half the year and speaks fluent Italian and is extremely well versed in all things Italian food, but especially cheese. And because of her experience living in Italy, when she's in New York, she doesn't go out for Italian food very much. She told me, you know, that I think she said that she's found one restaurant in New York that sort of lives up to her standard, and I can't remember what it is, of Italian food as it should taste in Italy. So, but she had friends come to town, and they wanted to go to Babbo, which is a pretty famous high-end Italian restaurant in New York, and she normally doesn't go to, but they wanted to go. They made a reservation, so she went. And she said that the waiter was grating cheese or offering to grate cheese over her pasta and said, would you like some Parmigiano Reggiano? And she looked at it and could see that it was Grana Padano, which is another Italian protected grating cheese, because these cheeses are embossed with their names on the crust. It's pretty obvious if you know what to look for on the rind. And she said, you know, are you sure that that's Parmigiano Reggiano? And he said, yes. And she's like, well, could I see it? And the waiter was sort of scared and ran off and came back a few minutes later with a different, smaller piece that she said was dried out. And, you know, her impression was that they went back in and were like, wow, we have some cheese nut who wants to see the real thing. And they found some leftover crumb of the real thing to serve her. Now, you know, this is her story. I wasn't there, but it's very believable because most people are not going to notice much of a difference if they grate some Grana Padano over your food, it's still a whole lot better than if they served you our domestic powdered Parmesan.
But the fact that this occurred in a restaurant like this, in a Mario Batali flagship restaurant, a restaurant of the highest caliber, that's really scary, because if such a thing can happen there, in a sense, such a thing can happen anywhere.
That's absolutely true. And just a couple of months ago, you know, Inside Edition did a expose on Kobe beef in restaurants, very similar to what I've written about. And one of the restaurants where they found, you know, Kobe beef on the menu that wasn't from Kobe was Le Bernardin in New York, which is arguably the top-rated restaurant in New York City, one of the top-rated restaurants in the world, 3 Michelin stars. And to their credit, you know, it was imported Japanese Wagyu, a very high quality. They admitted the error and changed the menu, but not everybody would do that.
Right. And so when you're talking about a restaurant with a chef like Eric Ripert, and something like this occurs, it's scary. And, of course, it doesn't even mean necessarily someone at the restaurant has done something knowingly wrong, but somewhere along the line, something conceivably could have occurred as well, in that long, complicated chain from producer to restaurateur, for instance. We should stay with cheese for just a moment, because your book opens with this wonderful celebration of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, and then sort of spelling out the ways in which everything else is but a pale imitator. You have another entire chapter devoted to other sorts of cheese stories, and one in particular I want you to talk about, because you mentioned the great state of Wisconsin where we are located, but this matter of Gruyere cheese, which is found in Switzerland, only in Switzerland. But there's a cheesemaker in Wisconsin who supposedly produces it. Say a word about this very special cheese, what makes it special, and why it just has to come from Switzerland.
Well, I mean, there are dozens of these cheeses that are unique to their terroir, and like Parmesan Reggiano, have been made for centuries in the same way, and usually the taste and style of the cheese is shaped by the cattle or the sheep or the goat and what they're eating and the climate. And Switzerland, you know, is famous for producing cheese, but Gruyere is their most famous cheese. And, you know, it's basically what, you know, we call Swiss cheese in this country, which, you know, they have no such thing called Swiss cheese in Switzerland. But when you go to a deli and you get Swiss cheese, it's a sort of homage to the taste of Gruyere. You know, it's not as refined, but that's sort of the general category of taste that Gruyere cheese has. And Parmesan and Roquefort and Manchego and a lot of these other famous European cheeses is not legally protected in the United States. So it's fine technically for a Wisconsin cheesemaker to make something and label it Gruyere. The difference is all of these European cheeses are very, very legally defined. When you buy Swiss Gruyere, you know exactly what you're going to get, pretty much what it's made of, which is, you know, no drugs, no hormones, no steroids, and no additives, but also pretty much exactly how it's going to taste. You can label anything you want that's made in the U.S. Gruyere of any quality. So it suddenly goes from, you know, being a very easy, transparent food to buy to being nebulous. And the interesting thing in the case of the Gruyere is, there's not a big market for Gruyere. It's a pretty small cheese commercially. I think there's only 7 dairies in the country that make something called Gruyere. And yet, during this trademark process that the Swiss producers went through, the U.S. deemed the term generic. And one of the reasons that they gave for deeming it generic, even though they acknowledged how little production of it was use of the term on the Internet. And if that's going to be sort of the definition for generic, then why isn't, you know, Apple and Microsoft and every song and every movie deemed generic? You know, so we have a policy in this country of very heavily protecting our entertainment and software industry and take the exact opposite approach to our food.
Hmm. I don't know if I don't recall this being mentioned in your book, but I thought you might be interested. I found a website called Cheese Notes, which I'd never visited before, but I was curious to find out where this Gruyere cheese I mean, with quotes around it, is being produced in Wisconsin, and came across a recent blog posting saying that I believe a cheesemaker in Monroe, Wisconsin, has decided it will drop the word Gruyere from one of its cheese names, giving in to pressure from its Swiss parent company and the Swiss Gruyere industry. So it sounds like you are pointing out something that is beginning to attract a bit of attention, and perhaps this is one sort of food fakery that is maybe meeting some kind of meaningful resistance.
I mean, I think there definitely is change afoot. And with the cheese, I just want to point out that this is not a European versus U.S. thing. We are the largest cheese producer in the world. A lot of people don't realize that. They associate, you know, cheese with France or with Switzerland. U.S. is the largest cheese producer in the world, and we produce some phenomenally excellent cheeses. I live in Vermont. I would argue that Vermont cheesemakers are, you know, equal with their European counterparts. I've been to Wisconsin, even beyond the cheese curds. some great cheddar, great cheeses. So it's not a broad brush. There's something wrong with the American cheese industry. It's just very similar to the champagne example. Good winemakers in this country who are making sparkling wine call it sparkling wine. The low-priced versions are the ones using the name champagne, and it's the same with cheese. These award-winning U.S. cheesemakers, they're not making copies of named European cheeses. They're creating original names like Humboldt Fog and Constant Bliss, and they're building brands with the way that quality companies have always worked.
Right, and I mean, they're not pretending that this is something that it isn't. You tell us one of the problems is the United States, in your words, has the most lax cheese labeling laws of pretty much any developed nation. So in other words, it sounds like here in America, you can slap on just about any name on just about any cheese. And I think that's what you're really calling into question.
Yeah, I mean, the cheeses really don't have any definition. So again, when you look at Gruyere or Parmigiano-Reggiano or Roquefort or Manchego in the U.S., I mean, in Europe, there is an extremely precise legal definition. What kind of milk, what kind of animal it has to be, what it can have, how it can be made, how long it has to be aged. And there are not even definitions of, like some of the grated Parmesan cheese sold in this country was found to be, you know, have mixed in cheddar and other cheese, you know, whatever was sort of left over or cheaper at the time. Part of the reason why you can't hold a cheesemaker accountable who's making Parmesan or Gruyere is because there's not even a definition of that. They can, you know, call whatever they want that. I think it's telling that the export of American versions of these European cheeses are banned in a lot of countries. And you're talking places like Honduras and Korea that won't take our cheese.
Wow. Because you just can't count on the label being truthful.
Exactly.
I appreciate, by the way, how you spell out the rich legacy of real Gruyere cheese. You say real Gruyere cheese was being made for more than 600 years before the Declaration of Independence was signed, and for centuries before Columbus even set sail for the New World. Real Gruyere has been made the same way, in the same place, since the year 1115. And yet, you know, for some U.S. senator who doesn't eat cheese, that's a distinction that they are unaware of and probably means nothing to them. But it obviously means a lot to you and to anybody who cares about wonderful, authentic food.
Well, you know, the founding fathers, when they signed the Declaration of Independence, they toasted it with Madeira, and Madeira has sort of fallen out of fashion. You know, it's like a port or a sherry, a fortified wine produced on the island of Madeira, which is in Portugal. But it was very popular at the time. It's what they chose to celebrate our independence with. And the idea at the time was to escape the oppression of other countries, not to oppress other countries, which is what we are in turn doing today with our wine and cheese industries.
Hmm. We're only going to be able to touch on a couple of other things, but I certainly want to make sure people understand the scope of your fascinating book. Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Larry Olmsted, author of Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. And again, it is a book that not only is sort of blowing the whistle on various kinds of food fakery, but it is also a wonderful celebration of the very best food that one can find in the world. You really seem to have a exceptional level of concern when it comes to fish. And in some respects, this seems to be an industry that is in which this kind of wrongdoing is especially rampant. You say the seafood industry is rife with fraud, substitution, and adulteration. Imagine if half the time you pulled into a gas station, you were filling your tank with dirty water instead of gasoline. That's the story with seafood. Just give us a sense of the scope of the problem.
Well, there have been a number of different tests, and what they usually do is buy seafood at both retail, in either supermarkets or specialty fish stores, and then in restaurants, and then take them to the lab and DNA test them, which is the kind of definitive identification of what species it actually is. And more than a third of the samples nationwide have typically failed to be what they purport to be, and that's a lot, but in some more desirable fish, it's much, much higher. In categories like sushi restaurants, it's much, much higher. In some big cities, it's much higher, you know, and because that, you know, national average also weighs the places on the coast where the fish is caught. So it's a big problem, and it's across all of these different kinds of seafood, shrimp and scallops and fin fish, and then there's different levels of fakery. There's farmed fish being substituted for, you know, what you're paying for wild caught. There's species being substituted, and in a lot of cases, the substitutes are actually dangerous. And the biggest part of this is the vast majority of the seafood that we eat in this country is imported. You know, I say 91% in the book, citing you know, the stats that were available at the time. But this week, New York Magazine came out with an article on this topic, and they say it's up to 95% of our seafood is imported, and yet less than 1% of that is inspected by the FDA, which is in charge of that. So we literally, you know, we don't know what's coming in, where it's from. A lot of seafood is transshipped, which means it maybe originates on a farm in China, but then goes to an intermediary country like Vietnam or Malaysia or Thailand and is relabeled as a product of that country because a lot of people are trying to avoid, say, eating food from China. So and the supply chain is much more obscure than it is with beef or pork, passes through countless middlemen. There's a lot of opportunity to change the labels. Nobody's wanting. So seafood is a big, big problem.
Hmm. There are a couple of fish that you point out as being especially problems of special severity. One of them is the odds of getting real white tuna in a restaurant. You say the odds are very slim. Describe the fish which you are almost certain to receive instead if you're not getting real white tuna. It's evidently a rather dangerous thing for us to consume.
It is, and this is a big problem with sushi because when you get a tuna steak, a lot of times if it's a yellowfin or bluefin tuna, you know, it has a little bit of kind of tone to the color. It's more recognizable to the eye, and the general rule of thumb with fake food is the harder it is to visually discern, the more it's faked. So the white tuna is widely used in the sushi industry, especially in rolls and the chopped-up spicy tuna, and where you just kind of can't see it as well. And the number one substitute for white tuna in sushi restaurants is a fish called escalar, which its nickname in the industry is the ex-lax fish because it's known to cause digestive distress. It's ironically banned in Japan, you know, which is where sushi comes from, but is also Japan is one of the most food safety obsessed countries, probably the safest place you can go and eat. And they banned it for 40 years, and it was actually at one point banned by an import order from the FDA in this country, but then unbanned. So, you know, here's a fish that's imported in fairly large quantities commercially, but nobody is ever going to the store and saying, give me a pound of Escalar.
Right.
You know, there's several of these fish that are brought into the country, as far as I can tell, for no good reason other than to deceive American consumers.
Right. You're right. While no one ever orders it, Escalar is one of the best-selling and most widely served fish in this country. It's just that it's never called what it actually is. It is... sold as something else, something much, much more desirable. You also point out that, in your words, if there is a poster child for fake fish, it's red snapper, and that essentially it's all but impossible to be getting actual red snapper if one is to order it. What is it about red snapper that makes it so rare, makes it so unlikely for that to be what's on your plate, even if that's what you ordered off the menu?
Well, there are several factors, but it's an excellent fish that has a good reputation, that so people want to eat red snapper because it tastes good. So that's why it's easy to sell. On the other hand, it's not a widely available, it's not a commercially prolific fish. It's actually fished in it's not farmed. It's a wild caught fish, and it's caught in fairly small quantities. So there's not nearly enough red snapper out there to actually meet the demand, and a lot of that demand is created simply by putting it on menus when it's not. And then there's a couple of other issues, one of which is that the way that the FDA allows fish to be labeled is they group lots and lots of species, sometimes related, sometimes not, under one label. So what can be, there's what they call true red snapper, which is red snapper, but then there's what you can call red snapper, which includes a lot, dozens of other types of fish. And then beyond that, there's fish that you're not allowed to call red snapper that are being widely served as red snapper. The number one substitute is tilefish, which is on FDA's do not eat list for pregnant women because it's so high in mercury. And I spoke to one scientist who kind of heads up the nonprofit that is, or the university research association that is working on barcoding all of the living things that we eat so that, you know, to make DNA identification easier. And I asked him for, his best tip on fake food, and he sort of threw up his hands and said, just don't ever order red snapper. That was his takeaway from, years of research.
Right. One of your strongest positions is about shrimp. And you've taken a very hard position when it comes to the shrimp that you will or will not order.
Right. Well, I think of, aquaculture across the board is not bad, especially as the world is growing in population. We need to have aquaculture sort of as part of our plan to feed the world. And aquaculture is particularly good when it comes to freshwater fish. They're in recirculating tanks. It can be very clean, closed system. But aquaculture is not so good when it comes to things that are grown in the salt water, meaning in, open bays and ponds. And of those, shrimp is probably the worst. And most of the shrimp is farmed in Southeast Asia. Most of it is farmed at farms with no oversight and very dubious track records, found to use antibiotics that have either been banned or are not approved in our country. And, a lot of people don't, everybody who's read Fast Food Nation or Food Inc. is somewhat familiar with feedlot cattle farming, but a lot of people don't realize that those same kind of practices, overcrowding, animals living in their own feces and being given a lot of drugs to keep them alive, happens in some aquaculture. And this is particularly true with these farm shrimp. Thailand is the number one provider of shrimp to the United States, yet, there's very little oversight. So I love shrimp, but I will only eat wild-caught shrimp, most of which comes from the Gulf of Mexico. And actually, domestically farmed shrimp is fine, but there's so little of it commercially available, most consumers will never see it. There's some out of North Carolina, and I think that's going to be a growing thing. I think, it costs more to do in this country, but it's done better.
Right.
In the future, you'll see more acceptable. The first domestic salmon farm ever to get approval from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Sea Watch program, just happened. So I think, you're going to see some gradual improvement in this.
And we should mention that each and every chapter ends with your tips on how someone can try to make sense of this. So, for instance, if you really want to try to buy good, authentic fish, think about searching out third-party certifications or buy Alaskan, buy American. shop at Whole Foods. And one of your surprising tips is shop at big box stores, because at least in some cases, some of these big box stores actually are doing a at least decent job of being careful with this.
Yeah, they're in a position where they do such volume with a limited number of providers that they can really dictate standards. You know, so for example, you know, Walmart recently became the number one seller of organic produce in the world. And if you say farm bell peppers for Walmart, a lot of times these companies, Costco, BJ's, whoever it is, will buy an entire farmer supply for the year. So you're essentially working for them. And they tell you, hey, you know, we want more organic. We're going to give you 3 years to get certified organic or to get this third-party seafood certification, or we're not going to buy from you. You're going to do it. And it's as simple as that. You know, I think sometimes the big box retailers, they have a reputation for bullying suppliers, but in this case, you know, they're bullying them in the right direction.
Mm. I wish we had time to talk about olive oil. That chapter is one of the most fascinating in the book. But I want to finish by returning to something we've touched on a couple of times. Champagne and scotch, or champagne, if we want to be more proper with the pronunciation. You spell out the way in which real champagne or champagne is created. If it's possible, in just a couple of minutes, can you summarize this wonderful process?
Well, I mean, like the Parmesan Reggiano cheese, every step of the process is dictated by law. And in the Champagne region, it's the most expensive vineyard land in the world, over $1 million an acre, over €1 million an acre. And yet the government has delineated the exact zones within the Champagne region where you're allowed to grow grapes based on the quality of the soil. And even in Champagne, grapes are grown on less than 2% of the acreage. They produce more potatoes than grapes. So, you know, from the very planting of the vines, it's hyper controlled for quality. They regulate the density of fruit, meaning, you know, you have to grow less grapes per plant so the quality doesn't get diluted. You have to have a license to prune the vines. You have to harvest by hand so the fruit isn't damaged. And 100% of the grapes used in making champagne has to come from Champagne, which is not the case with places like Napa and Sonoma, where it's a percentage. So you know, the government has regulated the grapes to be as good as they can be, and then the process of making the champagne, the minimum aging, the biggest thing that makes champagne is that the secondary fermentation takes place in the bottle. And what that means is first you make still wine, like you would any other wine, then you put it in a bottle and you add some yeast and sugar and you cap it, and it's the sugar the yeast eating the sugar and giving off carbon dioxide that forms the bubbles. That's how champagne becomes sparkling. And it's done in every individual bottle. You could view that bottle as its own winery. It's a very expensive, labor-intensive process. In other places, you can make sparkling wine in big bulk tanks and then put it in the bottle, or you can even make it by taking still wine and carbonating it just like you'd make soda, just pump gas into it. So the way it's made in Champagne is the most expensive, the time-consuming, just the grapes required to make a bottle of champagne cost between $7 and $10, and that's before you've done anything with those grapes, before you've crushed them, pressed them, aged the wine, made the wine, bought the bottle, bought the label. So when you can buy a bottle of domestic, quote-unquote, champagne for $8, you got to think, you know, what's in that?
Right. Well, and really, when it comes right down to it, it's not champagne, even though that's the word on the label. It's just not right to call it that. Call it something else. Call it sparkling wine or call it something else, but don't take that term and apply it to something that it simply isn't. I would say that's the central message of your book.
That's one of them.
The book is Real Food, Fake Food: Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. And again, every chapter ends with helpful tips from the author on how one can navigate through this really complicated landscape. And again, the book is as much about celebrating food at its most wonderful. The book is published by Algonquin Books. the author, Larry Olmsted. Larry Olmsted, what a pleasure to reconnect with you and to talk with you about your fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I welcome into the studios Laura Hermans, a young woman who grew up in Racine and has graduated from college and just completed a year's work in the nation of Rwanda through a group called a Young Adult Global Mission. We'll speak with her tomorrow about her experiences in Rwanda. On Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program to offer analysis of current events. On Thursday, you'll hear my conversation with Larry Tye,